Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Bob Saldick, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for today. Look for the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Bill George, professor at the moment at the Harvard Business School and the author of the new book, Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis. Bill George is the professor of management practice at the Harvard Business School. He is the author of several business bestsellers, including True North, Discover Your Authentic Leadership. His newest book, Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis, is the basis for his talk tonight. Mr. George is former chairman and chief executive officer of Medtronic, which he joined as president and chief operating officer in 1989, named CEO in 1991, and chair from 96 to 2002. Under his leadership, listen to this, Medtronic's market cap grew from $1.1 billion to $60 billion, averaging 35% a year. He has taught at IMIDE in Lausanne, Switzerland. He's taught at the University, Yale University's School of Management. He graduated from Georgia Tech. He has his MBA from the Harvard Business School. Prior to joining Medtronic, he was an officer in Honeywell. He holds several directorships, including ExxonMobil and Goldman Sachs. Mr. George has received many honors, and I'll just pick one out, which I think is pretty amazing. He was included by the PBS Nightly News as one of the 25 most influential business people of the last 25 years. With great pleasure, I introduce to you Bill George.
Thank you, Bob. It's a privilege to be here tonight, and I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for inviting me. I'm going to talk tonight about leading in a time of crisis. Certainly, I don't have to remind you that there's no shortage of crises these days. We heard from the president last night about the Afghanistan war and what we're planning to do about that. So we're in the midst of two wars. We certainly have a major health care crisis that doesn't seem like it's going to abate anytime soon, in spite of the legislation maybe coming out of Washington. We continue to have an ongoing energy and environmental crisis. And I think one of the most severe, which I'll talk more about, is the crisis we have in jobs and the need to spur innovation in the United States. A lot of people are saying, the economic crisis 2008-2009 is over. Well, I think that's in pure economic terms. The economists are probably right. Ben Bernanke said the recession officially ended in September, but it's a little bit like Hurricane Katrina. The hurricane's passed through, but now we have to deal with the aftermath. And I think in many ways the aftermath is much more severe than the economic crisis. It certainly affects many, many more people. It's true that the stock market yesterday hit a new high for a number of years, and GDP is up, and to the outside world, the economics look good. So what's the problem? I think the real problem we're facing today is one of jobs. We have 26 million people who are looking for full-time work that can't find full-time jobs. That's 17.5%, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, of our workforce. But more significant, we can't replace that with welfare, and it's taking much, much longer for people to find jobs. And I think the number is growing. Of the many, many CEOs that I talk to, I don't know anyone who's net hiring. Some are hiring replacement workers, but I don't know anyone who's actually hiring in the United States. Some are hiring overseas. Jobs have been thought of as a lagging indicator. I actually think we're in the midst of a more fundamental change. Now I want to return to this later in my talk to talk to you about how we're going to get out of this crisis, because I think it will lead to and is leading to a significant crisis of the human spirit. And I don't think we can substitute it again with either welfare or public service jobs for the long term. We can do things in the short term. How do we get into this mess? Well, I think it's really the culmination of 25 years of following a focus on maximizing shareholder value, which came out of Nobel Prize-winning Milton Friedman, was picked up by many, many people, and was devolved into maximizing short-term shareholder value. And as a result, we measured, I believe, the wrong things. We measured performance of companies by their stock price, their short-term stock price movements in the last 12 months, and we didn't really look at the economic value. We've seen a huge increase in the velocity of trading, as trading holding periods have dropped from 8.3 years to somewhere between 5 and 6 months. And I think we've certainly seen the rise of the short sellers and a lot of money moving very rapidly. I think as a society, the modus operandi has been focus on instant gratification and gaining that through more and more spending. As we know, many people went into debt to do that. And I think the thought was that people are motivated strictly by material goods and the acquisition thereof. I think this is a very, very flawed notion, and I think it's taken us way off course. As a result, I think the most severe thing is we've lost confidence in our leaders. The Kennedy School at Harvard came out with its annual survey of confidence in leaders, and the results were very disturbing to me. It showed that in response to the question, do you have confidence and trust in our leaders? Just across all fields of leadership, the 69% of the people said they had no confidence in our leaders. And then asked the question, if America does not get new leaders, we will decline as a nation. 67%, two-thirds of the people, answered affirmatively that if America does not get new leaders, we're going to decline as a nation. I can't say that I'm proud of what my generation has left the oncoming generations, but it's something that is very, very worrisome to me. And I think we've lost sight of the importance of sustainable leadership that can produce successful long-term results. And instead, we've turned to serving ourselves. And many, many leaders put their self-interest, their personal interest ahead of their institutions and destroyed many of the great institutions of my growing up years, companies like General Motors, AT&T, Sears Roebuck, and others were systematically, over years, we saw eroded by this short-termism. In fact, I think the root cause of the current economic crisis can be attributed not to subprime mortgages, to credit default swaps, or even excess liquidity, or the series of economic factors we see written about so much. I think we have to say that it is the root cause of the problem is leaders who practice short-termism. I don't think we can restore that confidence, to be very honest, until a new generation steps up and take over. No one's talking about it. We're going through a massive change in leadership right now. The baby junior generation will move out and into retirement over the next 10 years, and the new generations will be taking over. And I'm actually quite hopeful. I've seen in the new CEOs have been appointed since the fall of Enron, a very hopeful group of people taking over. Wall Street finally is going through a massive change right now at the top, where the old guard is stepping aside, many of them because their companies went bankrupt or they got forced out because of the problems they have. But I think it's finally triggered the change that's very, very much needed. What do I think we need? I think we need what I call authentic leaders, genuine people concerned more about building institutions and serving a worthwhile purpose and practicing their values than they are serving themselves. In my book, True North, I talked about this as leaders who follow their true north. What is your true north? Very simply, it's your beliefs, it's your values, and it's the principles by which you lead. I think most of us, if I asked each of us in the audience to write down what that was for you, you could write that down. That's not the issue. The issue is under pressure, and particularly in a crisis, will you be pressured away from your true north? Will you lose sight of the direction you're going and not tell the truth? Or will you do the short-term things to get through? Or will you skim by and think you can get away with it and make it up next year? Or will you be seduced by material rewards of money, fame, power, and glory? And I think in many ways the material acquisition has been more a desire for power and status than it has the money per se. If you look at people that are earning hundreds of millions or billions, it's certainly clear that they can't spend that money, and it's really more an acquisition of power. I think what we're seeing now is a very significant shift, though, between 20th century leadership and 21st century leadership. In my growing up years, we venerated the great man. We had the great man theory of leadership, which today is, I think, a totally flawed notion. We shouldn't set President Obama up as a great man. He's just a human being like all the rest of us. And we believed in command and control leadership. And I can tell you, command and control leadership will not work in this generation. The young people coming up, but people working in our organizations want meaning, not just money. And there may be a few that want money, but I tell you, the masses of people want to find meaning in their work. they have options, and they'll move on if they don't find the kind of leadership they look for. And so I'd like to propose a new notion of 21st century leadership tonight, which I would define in four words: align, empower, serve, and collaborate. Let me explain what I mean by each of those. My colleagues at Harvard Business School on the finance faculty say that when I talk about aligning people around a sense of mission and values, that that's a soft side of leadership. I'll tell you from my experience as a CEO, that's not soft at all. That's the hard stuff. The easy part is getting the numbers right. Anyone can get the numbers right in the short term. Anyone can go in and turn around, a group of us can go turn around any organization in the short term. We all know what to do. We just cut out the half of the research. We cut Salesforce 30%, cut salaries 10%, eliminate all bonuses and travel expenses and all development, and you'll get the numbers up. But you may destroy the enterprise. That was something I feared every day at Medtronic as CEO. So I think the real challenge, particularly in a global organization, how do you align people around a common mission and values? And if you don't do that, how do they know what to do? One of the companies that does this the best is Johnson & Johnson with their credo, where they very clearly say our customers come first, and then our employees, and then our communities, and then our shareholders. And I think that they certainly served their shareholders well over the last 40 or 50 or 60 years, but because they did those other things well. But if you're in Greece or in Alabama or in South Africa or Korea, how do you know what to do? You can have a rule book here that has 6 inches thick of rules, but you won't know what to do under pressure unless you know the values of the organization. And you can't, I would say, sustain an organization unless people have a common mission, which they're working for. At Medtronic, we work this all the time, the notion that we are there to restore people to full life and health. And the thing I'm proudest of at Medtronic is not the significant increase in market capitalization. It's the fact that when I went there, we had 300,000 people. We restored every year to full life and health. And these days, that number is over 10 million people. Our new patients are restored every year to full life and health. And I think that's really the mission that people came around. If I went to see Medtronic employees and I said, we need to get the quarterly earnings up, they'd give me a blank stare because they don't know how to do that. They do know how to help patients. They do know how to produce a quality product. They do know how to innovate products that will help save lives, and that's what turns them on. Well, the second point really has to do with empowerment. I think we've looked at this notion of leadership as having power over other people. That, too, is, I believe, a flawed notion, that leadership is not about exerting power over other people. The real quality of leadership is to empower other people to step up and lead. And if you can do that, you can become a great leader, because we don't need a few great leaders at the top. What we need are hundreds, if not thousands, of leaders throughout organizations who can provide, who are empowered to make a difference. I'll give you a little example. I came to Medtronic's facility in Irvine, California, a number of years ago, and the business does, it's in the heart valve business, and they take pig's hearts and they take the valve out and they make it into a heart a valve that can be used to replace the human aortic or mitral valve. The business was heavily backlogged. It took about 18 months to train workers, mostly immigrants, legal immigrants from Southeast Asia. And I met the top worker in the facility, a woman named Trin. And I went out to her bench, and I said, Trin, you know, I'm an engineer. Explain to me how you do this process. How can you produce 1,000 valves and no one else comes close? She said, she looked at me, she wouldn't look down at her bench. She said, Mr. George, she had this passion in her eyes. She said, you know, this fire in her eyes. She said, I make heart valves that save people's lives. And, yeah, we have a manual about quality here, but there's no quality inspectors on this line. I do all my own inspection. And my criteria here is this valve good enough to go in my father or my husband or my daughter? And if it's not, it never leaves my bench. She said, you know, I make 1,000 valves a year. If one of those valves is effective, someone's going to die. And if that happened, I could never live with that. Now, to you at Medtronic, 99.9% quality may be very good, but that's not acceptable to me. She said, but you know what I think about when I go home at night? I think about those 5,000 people who are alive today in the world and having full lives because of the heart valves I make. Now, there's an empowered person. There's an empowered leader. Does anyone doubt that she's really a leader? She's the one that trains all the people in the production line. She's the one that sets the quality standards. These are the kind of people we need throughout organizations who can step up and lead each in their own environment. The third criteria is service. And I think we've had this idea that we're in business to serve the shareholders. I reject the notion that management's there to serve the shareholders. We're there to serve the customers. And any business that does not do that better than its competitors will be out of business. That's what happened to General Motors. They were trying to serve the short-term shareholder, and they lost sight of their customers, and they started blaming everyone else, including the federal government. I believe that we're there to serve customers, and that's what turns our employees on. And as leaders, we're there to serve our employees. That's our job. They're not there to serve us. We're there to serve them. Dave Dillon, who's the CEO of Kroger, is a friend of mine, and he went to Kroger at a time when they were losing market share rapidly to Walmart. They're unionized. Walmart's non-union had about 15% cost advantage on them. He said, what we did is we got alignment around the proposition that serving the public in a service-oriented grocery operation is a proud, dignified profession. Little touches of human kindness can actually change our customers' days. And if I'm the deliverer of that human kindness, I feel better about myself as well. At the end of the day, we can all look back and say I was part of something special. Isn't that what we all want? Don't you want to look back and say, I was really part of something special. This was really a special organization. We really made a difference. Well, the fourth criteria is collaboration. I think as leaders today, we need to be collaborative. The problems we're tackling are so complex today that they cannot be solved by any one person or any one group of people. We need to be able to collaborate between groups and bring people together, either within our organization or on a global basis with other organizations, with our customers, as we try to do at Medtronic, to bring doctors into the mix and make them feel part of the family, or even with our competitors. Many people out in Silicon Valley do that so well. Well, so I believe that the successful 21st century leader will be people who can align people around a mission and values, can empower other people to step up and serve, and recognize their job is to serve, and who can create a collaborative spirit. Well, I wrote seven lessons because I felt like we'd gotten so far away from that. And in my book, I talk about how did we get away from that. And I really believe that crisis is the test for any leader. We had the wind at our back in the years I was at Medtronic, and you think you're pretty good when you're growing. Growth covers up a lot of sins. When things are stable, you're just really managing. But really, the challenge of leaders is a crisis. And until leaders, and particularly young leaders, have faced a crisis, they never know how good leaders they are. Early in my career, I had put together a strategic plan for Litton Industries to get into the consumer microwave oven business. And after about 4 months, I was deputized to go up and be the assistant general manager because they'd gotten in some difficulties. The night I was packing my bags to move to Minneapolis, the radio announcer came over and said, the Surgeon General of the United States has just announced that microwave ovens may be hazardous to your health. Well, it was a great way to start a new job, I can assure you. And I got there the next day, and this young division of a couple hundred people was swimming in chaos. It was mass chaos. And I remember I'd worked in the government, going back to the government and talking to the person we identified as the one giving us the hard time and trying to set these impossible qualities, possible radiation standards we had to meet. And Dr. Robert Elder, and I remember Dr. Elder said to me, he said, Mr. George, let me tell you something. He said, I'm doing you a huge favor here. Your business is just getting started, and we're going to set a really tight standard, and you're going to be able to fix it right now, and rather than when you have millions of products out there on the market. And he made me very mad, but he actually was absolutely right. So we went back, and we were challenged. We had a design that wasn't very robust, and we didn't know many mornings whether we could even produce the next day. After about a week, our executive vice president from corporate came into the business, and I'm the young guy, 27 years old, trying to explain to him that the products are really safe, the safety factor the government's imposing on us is unrealistic, and we had a 10,000 times safety factor built into the products, and he said to me, I don't care, we're just going to recall everything we've made. You have to recall all the products, which is about 1,100 products we'd shipped. You know, he probably saved the business with that arbitrary decision. He didn't need any analysis. He intuitively knew that this was not right, and he saved in that crisis by his action. And it took us a long time to get it right, a lot of redesigns. I learned a lot about the mistakes you can make. In fact, some of these lessons that I relearned at Medtronic came from those early experiences, like going into the factory at 3:30 in the morning, trying to get started up at 6:30, and not knowing if we had a design that could be produced the next day. So I would say to all the young people in the audience, it's essential that you put yourself on the firing line, not being a consultant or an analyst, but actually get into the game and face the challenges. Well, the first lesson is face reality starting with yourself. That sounds pretty obvious, doesn't it? Well, why don't people do that? I find under pressure so many people will not face reality. I think a lot of it has to do with our unwillingness to admit our mistakes. Some people just are denying bad news, and so they very carefully shoot the messenger. Every time messenger to come in, I was on a program, had Jamie Dimon on a panel. I was moderating out in Davos, Switzerland last January, and he said, he told a story. He said, I was at a management conference, and a woman said to me, Mr. Dimon, you need one person in your team as a truth teller. He said, ma'am, with all respect, if I have one person on a team who's a truth teller, I need to fire the other nine because I need everyone on the team to tell me the absolute truth. And I think in a lot of hierarchy organizations, we've lost sight of just how important it is to have a culture of candor and openness where we describe real problems and the boss, if you will, the people responsible are open to hearing that and are not shooting the messenger, actually rewarding people for that. But, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with looking ourselves in the mirror and acknowledging our own problems. It's very easy to fix someone else's problems. It's very hard to face your own. I remember shortly after I joined Medtronic, I appointed, reorganized the operating side of the company and appointed a new president of Europe, a Dutchman who was a very skilled operator who had joined the company in a subsidiary organization about 4 years before and promoted him to president of Europe. And I had a few signals that there might be some issues with him, like being too aggressive. And I said, that's exactly what we need. Europe is undisciplined. We need to put some discipline in here. Well, 4 months later, our general counsel and our chief internal auditor came to my office, and general counsel closed the door. Folks, when your lawyer closes the door, you always know you're in trouble. And we were in trouble. And they had uncovered a bribery scheme that this person had been leading for actually some 10 years before Medtronic acquired the company. And so I asked him to come over, and first thing he said to me is, I asked him, did he, this compliance statement, I showed him you signed this statement, and he said, look, let me tell you something. You Americans are trying to impose your values on us Europeans. And I said, no, John, these are not American values. These are Medtronic values. They're the same all over the globe, and you're going to have to go away. Now, frankly, that was the easy part. Terminating, it's never fun, but that was the easy part. The hard part was looking myself in the mirror and say, Bill, why did you appoint this person without checking out his values? And so I had to go back to the board of directors, and I was new on the board. I'd been on about 9 months, and my new executive committee, and acknowledged to them that I'd made a big mistake, that it wasn't about him, it was about me, and that I'd made a mistake in not checking out his values. But you learn from those lessons. Kevin Scher tells a story about how he learned at Amgen. They had a drug called Aranesp, which was a highly successful drug, his big drug after he became CEO, replacing Epogen and Neupogen, $4 billion drug. And they were selling it off-label, promoting heavy dosages of the product, and they started to get some studies back showing problems, that people were being harmed with this product. And there was a lot of denial at Amgen. And they started to attack the federal regulator who was putting pressure on him to take action on the drug or recall it. And finally, he said to his executive team, if you were that federal regulator, how would this look to you? And the scientists around the table acknowledged it would look pretty bad. So Kevin tasked his top people to go out and get the problem solved. Well, 2 weeks goes by, nothing happens. 4 weeks goes by, nothing happens. 6 weeks goes by, nothing happened. Everyone's frozen in place, still in a state of denial, realizing this could really harm the business. And so Kevin says, sitting in a shopping mall waiting for a daughter, pick up his daughter, and he says, Kevin, what role do you have in this problem? And he said, you know, I pulled out a piece of paper, and I made up a list. It turned out it was a long list, my responsibility for the problem. So I called my troops back together, and I said, I'm going to actually read to you the mistakes I made. And he said they were shocked that a CEO would admit his error so openly. He said, but that then freed them up to go and take responsibility for the mistakes they'd made, put a plan together. They lost $1 billion in revenue as a result of this, but they saved 3/4 of the drug, and it's still on the market. But I think if they hadn't done that, it probably would have gone the route of some other drugs like Fen-Phen or Vioxx, where there was organizational denial. Well, the second lesson is don't be Atlas. Get the world off your shoulders. I know I felt every day at Medtronic that I was carrying a huge burden on my shoulders. I think what we just really need to do today with the complexities of leading. There's nothing worse than leaders like Richard Fuld Lehman, which went into his office and disappeared during the crisis and really didn't take action because he was frozen in place. None of us is that heroic. We've got to pull together key people around us that represent very diverse points of view, diverse experiences that can offer that candor to us. I also think we need external reference points. I use my wife, Penny, very extensively for that. I have three mentors I can call anytime, or four mentors, to ask for advice and counsel. I have a men's group I can meet with when I'm facing very difficult times. But I think we need that to relieve the pressure and to help us keep perspective. Because inside an organization that's under siege, under crisis, it's very easy to develop kind of a point of view that may not be realistic with the outside. Due to time, I'm going to combine lessons three and four. Lesson three is dig deep for the root cause, and lesson four is get ready for the long haul. You know, oftentimes when you see the first signs of a problem, people bring it to you, and your first reaction was, well, let's get that fixed. It can't be that bad. I can tell you from my experience, things will get worse. Almost inevitably, you're looking at the tip of the iceberg, and things will go from bad to worse. Serving on the board of Goldman Sachs, I got to see these things up close and personal during the last 2.5, 3 years serving on the board. As early as the first quarter of 2007, management came to us with long faces about problems they discovered in their subprime mortgage business. And they had lost about $70 million. And, of course, the board's question, what are you going to do about it? And they said, we're getting out of the business. Well, another 6 months went by, and they had a very bad day in August of 2007 in which three of their quantitative funds went down 30 to 40%. And what they saw as a result of that is a huge amount of volatility in the market. And because of that, they realized that the models they saw were just not working, that there was something fundamentally going on in the market. And they made they recognized that the root cause of this was not quant funds going down a day, not subprime mortgages, but something, the market was not working in the way they expected it would. So they changed their strategy to go to maximizing what they call global excess liquidity, which is also cash. And they put emphasis on maximizing their cash position. So by the time the crisis hit in September 2008, they had built up a cash position over $125 billion, which many other banks did not do. Had they not done that, they might have found themselves in the same shape as Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers. They really got ready for the long haul. And I think it's way too easy to underestimate a crisis. They recognized that the root cause of this crisis was the huge volatility taking place in the market, and things could swing. And, of course, subsequently you saw this huge swing in the price of oil, which it went from, $142 a barrel down to all the way to $33. But they were prepared for those kind of swings because they had gotten ready for the long haul. The Chinese symbol for crisis is made up of two characters, danger and opportunity. And I think we think about the dangers of the crisis. Everyone's concerned about that. What could go wrong? What could go down? We saw Dubai last week get in trouble, and everyone's saying, what could go wrong next? But I think we miss the opportunities. And I think Machiavelli had some wisdom about that. He said, you know, never waste the opportunities of a good crisis. And I think crisis presents your best opportunity to make fundamental change in an organization. When things are going well, it's very hard to get out the fat to drop excess business. Businesses are underperforming. It's very, very hard to do. In a crisis, you can create fundamental change. And I think great leaders focus on how can they create fundamental change in their organization in a time of crisis. And so in thinking about that, let's look at the two major automobile companies, General Motors and Ford. General Motors time and time again passed up good crises. They had an opportunity about 20 years ago. They got the federal government to put tariffs on foreign cars and limit the number of foreign cars. They had a three-year period to get things right. What did they do? They raised prices. Earnings went up. Stock price went up. Everyone said this is great. Meanwhile, Toyota and the other foreign producers saw that they had a real problem. They had to increase the value of their automobiles, both in features and in lower cost, and they did so. So after 3 years, General Motors actually was in a much weaker position than they'd been when they got the federal tariffs put on after they went off. So they wasted that crisis opportunity. They never made the fundamental change in their organization. The flaws I saw there in the 1950s were there as recently as this past year. Ford 3 years ago went outside the industry and hired a new CEO, Alan Mulally, who came in from Boeing. Within 90 days, not 3 months, Mulally went to the banks and he borrowed $23.5 billion. And they said, boy, you must be in real trouble, Mr. Mulally. He said, no, we're getting ready for the long haul and we need the cash as a backup in case there's a recession or something happens. And the stock price went down significantly when he did that. Well, he who laughs last, laughs best. And last fall when the automobile market went off the cliff, it was Ford that didn't need to go to the run to the federal government and get bailed out that wasn't bankrupt. And today, Ford has $23 billion in cash in the bank. But more significantly, they've got a 3-year head start on General Motors in redesigning their cars, designing cars that people want. And General Motors has just really been starting in the last 6 months and is way behind, as you saw with yesterday's change in management. It's evident that the problems are very, very deep. It's not just financial problems, but they have tremendous problems. And I think that's a compare and contrast of what it means to take advantage of a crisis. Mulally took advantage of it. He actually created it by getting this debt and anticipating what could come. And so when the crisis hit, he was prepared, and he could make the fundamental changes in his organization, make the changes in his design team, and make the changes in his product line, not do it after the fact, after you're already in deep trouble. Well, lesson number 6 is you're in the spotlight. Follow your true north. You know, a lot of us are very uncomfortable being with the media, being quizzed, being with security analysts. This is a real test, and it's not a lot of fun. I've missed earnings numbers one quarter. I remember I had 350 people in a room with me, and they were calling me everything from a liar to all this, and it's not a lot of fun. But I think it is the test of, can you follow your true north? Can you stay on track of what really matters? These days, I think we have to say that you have to take approach using transparency. There is no idea that you can keep things secret. You can communicate one thing to your employees, another thing to the outside world. Basically, internal and external communications have morphed into one. I remember doing a chairman's briefing in Medtronic a few years ago, and I was giving a talk like this, and I got back to my office about the talk ended about 10 to 10. I got back to my office shortly after 10, and I went on, and I explained we had this particular problem we had. I went online and found out that Reuters had a release out at 9:29. Well, I was still halfway through my talk. And so things move very quickly today. And if you don't tell your employees the full story, they aren't going to believe what you say. You can't put out pressers. You can't do videos. You can't hide in your office. They will not believe. You got to tell the media. You got to tell everyone the full story. I tell you, because it'll be out on the blogs, and your employees will believe what's in the media. They'll believe what's on the blogs. And I think open communication is essential. A couple of stories here. Mattel Corporation, the nation's leading toy company, had a consumer founding led in children's toys. You recall the story a couple of years ago. And they had to recall 14 million toys. And the CEO, Robert Eckert, went in front of Congress. And he said, Mr. Eckert, what happened? He said, oh, it wasn't Mattel that did this. It was those Chinese contract manufacturers. And he emphasized the word Chinese to the point where one senator said, I suppose now Chinese made in China means is a warning label. Well, it wasn't very funny. Got a good laugh. But Eckert never took responsibility. It's his name on the product. You know, he was giving his trust of his company to all the consumers and customers and all the children and all the mothers and fathers who were buying his toys. And compare that with the problem JetBlue had. JetBlue was founded by Dave Neilman, who came to my classroom a few weeks ago. And Dave created this airline based upon customer service. And Neilman was really committed to that. Well, on Valentine's Day 2007, everything shut down. They had people on runway stranded up for 10 hours. He went down to the control room. It was mass chaos. Their young team couldn't keep up with it. They had to cancel 1,000 flights the next day. What did Neilman do? First thing he did is he put out a public video on his website and apologized to everyone, all the consumers that this had happened to. Then he went on the Letterman show. He went on Today. He went on CNBC and apologized for what had happened. He also then introduced the first ever customer bill of rights, saying we will compensate you for the difficulties we cause you if we're responsible, even though it's an ice storm that they didn't really create the ice storm. He took full responsibility for that. And as a result, JetBlue's reputation recovered very well because they were getting hit harder than anyone else because they had built their reputation on customer service. You built your reputation on something, you have to stand by it. And he did that. Now, ironically, he actually lost his job over that because some of his board members thought he was being too open. And he came to my classroom, and he was quizzed by this intensely by the students after he'd studied the case. And he said, yeah, I lost my job, but I kept my integrity. Now he's back doing it all over again with an airline in Brazil called Azul, which means blue. But those are two interesting examples that I can give you that I think in this day and age you need to be fully transparent, need to be fully open. You may not know everything, but you need to tell people everything you do know. Well, the final lesson is go on offense. Focus on winning now. I think that that's what we as a country need to do. And I've seen great leaders do this. In a time of crisis is the one time you can totally change the game. All the rules are changed. People that think the markets are coming back just like they were before this crisis, they're never coming back. The automobile dealerships will never look like they were. The restaurant business is not going to look like it was. The hospitality business. Things have changed in fundamental ways. And I think it's up to us as leaders to figure out how can we change the game. Look what Steve Jobs did when he came back to Apple. He realized he couldn't get traction in the computer business, so he brings out the iPod and then iTunes and then the iPhone and totally changed four industries. Amazing, the things he's done in transforming that. Indra Nooyi, when she became CEO of PepsiCo, 2006, a great leader. You know, first thing she did, she said, I recognize that 90% of our profits come from sugar-based drinks and high-fat foods. And she said, I'm going to change that because I recognize there's an enormous obesity crisis that's not coming. It's here. It's part of us. And so she committed that by 2010, 50% of PepsiCo's revenues would come from healthy foods and healthy beverages. Well, that's only a month away. And then she devoted a very large amount of the company's profits to go into a foundation to campaign against obesity, whereas this is something many people won't talk about. But here's a person who went on offense and tried to change the game. I think in this jobs crisis, I said I'd come back to that. I'd like to come back to that. I think as a country, we're too satisfied with talking about saving jobs. Jobs will come back, lagging indicator. No, we need to go on offense. We need to create jobs. And we need to play to the great American strengths. What are they? Creativity, innovation, entrepreneurship, and new company formation. Today, if you're a big company, you can get money. There's plenty of money out there. There's a lot of liquidity. If you're an entrepreneur and you want to start a new company, like many of my students, it's almost impossible to get money today. Small business cannot get loans. Big business can. Small business cannot. So it's very hard. Where do the jobs come from? 70% of the jobs are created by small business. There was a study out saying that since 1980, 29 years ago, that all the net jobs added in this country have come from companies less than 5 years old. You think about in my lifetime, my business lifetime in the last 25 years, companies like Walmart and Target, where I served on the board, Amazon, Microsoft, Intel, Cisco, Google, they basically didn't exist 25 years ago. These are the great job creators of the last 25 years, not the old line companies. Well, who are they going to be the next ones to come along? Who's going to be the next Facebook, the next YouTube? I think we need to go to an era of being very aggressive and focusing on innovation and creativity and new company formation. And the government, if it's going to do anything, instead of putting out packages to give us tax cuts, should we be putting money behind job creation? What should we be doing? We should be doing things like we should change the capital gains law so it's not a long-term gain if 1 year and a day. That's not long-term. We should have a sliding scale for capital gains. If you hold capital a long time, you get the lowest rate. President Obama in his campaign had a proposal, which never has come to light since then, that if you started a new company or you invested in a startup company, when that company was sold, you'd pay zero capital gains. Think what about a boon that would be for new company formation. I'd like to see us double the R&D tax credit and make it permanent, and so we can really put the emphasis on innovation in this country. And then I'd like to see, frankly, export credits and jobs credits, all things are going to help us stimulate kind of quality jobs, not minimum wage jobs, but kind of quality jobs. My own company went from 4,000 people when I joined it to 38,000 today. That's nothing like Walmart or Target, but those are significant, well-paying jobs. And I think we can do that. But as a country, we need to go on offense and turn this thing around. We can't just sit back and assume that the numbers are all going to right themselves. They're not. It's not going to happen. We've seen a fundamental shift in labor markets to a global labor market, and a lot of the low-cost work is going overseas. I can tell you T-shirts are not coming back to North Carolina. The low-labor, low-tech manufacturing business is not coming back. So we need to focus on things and play to our strengths. That's what great leaders do on offense. I think that's what we do. That's what we need to do. Well, let me conclude my talk by talking about crisis could be your defining moment. This crisis could be your defining moment. This could be the opportunity to redefine your life and your career. I had one of those experiences 20 years ago. I was driving home. I was an executive vice president at Honeywell. I was running about a third of the company. I was in line to become CEO along with one other person, and my wife had a good job. I'm coming home to our house. It's on a small lake right in the center of Minneapolis, and my sons are just going into high school. They have a good life. We love our community. I look myself in the mirror, and I'm miserable. Now, how can you be miserable in a situation like that? What I realized in that instant is I was losing it. You know, I was working so hard to become CEO of this big company that I was losing sight of trying to be the value-centered leader that I thought I was to be ever since I was a little boy. And in that instant, I realized that, you know, I was playing the game, the corporate game. I was even wearing cufflinks, which I don't wear, to impress the board of directors and other members of management and really playing the game. And so I went home and told my wife this, and she said, Bill, I've been trying to tell you this for a year. You just didn't want to listen. It's always a person closer to us that sees us who we really are. At that time, I turned down Medtronic for a job three times. And she said, why don't you call him back? I was kind of proud. And I said, well, okay. So I called him back, and I talked to Earl Bakken, the founder. I talked to Win Wallen, the CEO. I said, this is the kind of company where I should be. It was the job I went into was number two in a company. It was about a quarter the size of the business I was running at Honeywell. But, you know, size doesn't matter. What mattered is this was a place where I could, as I felt that first day when I walked in, I felt like I was coming home. Home to a place I'd never been before with a group of people that I could learn from. Hopefully they could learn a little from me. But more importantly, we were doing really important work in restoring people to full life and health. And that turned out to be my defining moment. But had I not been in that state of crisis, I don't think I ever would have made that decision. I would have just gone on the merry way I was on. So I had to face the reality of my own crisis. And in doing that, it really did change my life because I was at the time at Medtronic, those 13 years were the best years of my professional life. Well, Robert F. Kennedy in his lifetime said something I want to just share with you in closing. He said, few will have the greatness to bend history itself. There's a few people we can all think of, but most of us are never going to bend history. And he went on to say, but each of us can commit to a small series of actions in our own environment to make a difference in the world. And the sum total of all our actions will write the history of this generation. So I want to say to all of you younger people that are going to be and are the leaders of the future, think about how your actions. You don't have to go run the country. You don't have to be president. You don't have to be CEO. You can make a difference right in your own environment right today. And think about where your passions are and where you want to make a difference. And like I say, this crisis could be your defining moment. It could be the opportunity when you change course, find that thing where you really can make a difference and set yourself on a course that leads to a lot of great opportunities. Because at the end of the day, the only thing you can take with you is what you leave behind. And I think I'd like to challenge each person in this audience to think about, when you leave this world, what is the legacy you leave behind? I don't think it's you're going to be that you've made so much money that your grandchildren never have to work a day in their life. I hope it's going to be, you can say you've really made a difference in the lives of people you serve. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Bill George, professor currently at the Harvard Business School and the author of the new book, Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis. It's now time for our audience question period. We have a lot of questions. Professor George, let me start. You talked at the end of your talk about the problems facing Barack Obama, and you listened to his talk yesterday, you mm-hmm. said, several people have asked us, what would you do to help Barack Obama achieve the objectives you have written about? What should he do? And a related question is, how can bipartisan cooperation be achieved in Congress regarding anything, especially health care reform? Is bipartisan success possible?
I'm not a politician. I don't work in Washington, so I have to give you that caveat.
That's good. That's the good part.
I empathize with the president who has all these crises coming at him, certainly ones that were not of his making in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I think he's making very difficult decisions and based on the information he has, and I think we have to all support him now. But I'm much more concerned about the problems here at home. I'd like to neutralize those problems in Afghanistan and Iraq and move on so we can get on to solving the problems at home. And having been in the healthcare field for a long time, I can tell you these problems are getting worse, and they're not going to get better until we start facing reality. Let's take healthcare. We've taken a political approach. I'd like to see every American have access to healthcare. It's embarrassing. It's worse than embarrassing. It's shameful that here the wealthiest nation on earth can't provide health care for all its citizens. But health care is far too complex to just say we're going to give everyone access to insurance. There are significant elements of quality, which are not right. There are significant elements of cost, which are not right. And the most significant of all is lifestyle. 70% of all health care costs from our lifestyle. We don't call it that. We call it cardiovascular disease. We call it spine disease. We call it cancer. We call it diabetes. I was in the Medtronic diabetes business. These things come from our lifestyle. These are a product of things like obesity that we don't want to talk about. They're products of alcohol. They're products of other things, smoking, that lead to very serious health problems. Why we won't step up and take on that is a national health and wellness. So I think each of these problems needs to be taken. The reason I think we haven't addressed the jobs crisis, the health care crisis, the energy crisis is because we're looking for short-term quick fixes. We're worried about the 2010 elections. If I were the president, I would advise him to not worry about getting reelected in 2012, just figure out what's going to be the best thing for the nation and how can he solve some of these problems in the long term. They probably won't be solved on his watch, but we've got to get on the right course. Today, we're not on the right course in many of these things, and the trends are going against us, and the legislation we're producing, frankly, has more unintended consequences and more counterproductive activities often than it does positive activities. So at least as in healthcare reform, I'd like us to follow the first rule of medicine, which is first, do no harm. So if our legislators could follow the thing that all doctors take in their oath, to do no harm, I hope they could pass that test when they get done with this camel that's being created in Washington.
You described a lot of government problems, and you also mentioned General Motors as an example of a troubled corporation.
Yes.
And they conveniently fired their CEO yesterday. So when you get hired as a consultant to General Motors, what will you tell them to look for?
Long-standing problems require long-term solutions. They're not going to fix General Motors in a year or two. This problem's been festering. I grew up in Michigan. I've seen it festering in their cars since the late 50s, okay? And so it's a series of internal CEOs, all of whom have a financial background. I tell them, get some people that love cars that know how to design cars. If you don't love medical products, if you don't love defibrillators, you shouldn't work for Medtronic. You know, I mean, you got to, not all of us can design that, but we need to be in touch with what does that customer really want, and they don't have products that people want, and they've got to get that. There's no short-term quick fixes they can get there, and they've got a massive overhaul. My friend Ed Whitaker is the chairman. He had a lot of courage, I think, to take that job on, not being an automobile guy. I'm sure yesterday's decision was very painful. But they, frankly, this is one company, much as I believe in internal promotions, need some outside blood. They're going to have trouble getting it because of the financial limitations of the U.S. government on being able to pay a reasonable salary. He told me the other day he can't hire a CFO because he can't offer him more than a total salary of $500,000. Well, now, to most of us, that sounds very good, but to the kind of quality CEOs they want to run what used to be one of the world's largest companies, they need to at least have an adequate salary base so they can attract top talent. They got to get the right people on the bus, and they need to get some outside thoughts. This is an organization in total denial, and Whitaker can't change it for chair of the board. No CEO can change it. They're going to have to change things top to bottom. It's very much a remake like what Jack Welch did at GE, and it's going to be very painful, and they'll probably call the new CEO Neutron something, but it's going to take that if we want to save the company. There's no quick fix here.
That leads right into a question, and there are several questions from the audience about executive compensation. So this one is phrased, can we find good leaders in the business world that don't demand exorbitant compensation? Why isn't a few million dollars a year enough? And what about the Wall Street salaries that people or money that people walk away with? Are you comfortable with that as a director of a major Wall Street firm?
Well, I've been uncomfortable for 10 years with all the salary trends because I think we paid the money to the people on top and didn't spread it throughout the organization. In fact, many people got very large bonuses living off the backs of their employees by cutting back on employee compensation and employee jobs. We've got a big problem, and I think it's very hard to adjust where we are today back to a reasonable level. And this is a very painful thing right now because there's a lot of competition that is salary-based, and that's unfortunate, and people need top talent. And I think it is an enormous dilemma. I am a very strong believer in long-term pay for long-term performance. I don't think we should allow people to get access to money in the short term, and I mean 3 years as short term. I serve chairman of the Compensation Committee of Exxon, the world's largest company. There, 70% of your compensation is withheld until retirement or 10 years, whichever is the greater. And I think if Goldman Sachs is going much more in this direction, or if all the financial firms could do this and stop giving guaranteed compensation for questionable performance and get to a pay-for-performance long-term and get away from stock prices as a criteria, we'll be better off. I think we still have to compensate people well, but we need to spread that throughout the system, recognizing leadership falls into many, many hands. This is not going to be an easy one to solve. With the genie out of the bottle, it's very hard to put that genie back in, so I don't want to underestimate that. The anger out there is palpable. You know it's enormous right now, but anger itself is not going to solve this problem. And just doing things like the Dodd Amendment, it's not going to solve it either.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program or TV program. Today we're speaking with Bill George, professor at the Harvard Business School, who is discussing how individuals can turn a crisis such as the current recession into an opportunity for success. A crisis of unemployment is really plaguing the country, and several people have asked about that. This questioner says, you talk about the crisis of unemployment. What about the crisis of those still employed or asked to take on more work with less resources? Are we burning out? How do we fix that problem?
I think we probably are burning some people out. I think, I admire what Lee Scott did after he became CEO of Walmart. Walmart, the world's highest, largest employer, now probably the largest company. They have 2 million people. And I think when he recognized that they were actually burning people out, he actually went out and advocated for an increase in the minimum wage, saying we don't pay minimum wage. But I think this is happening through a lot of industry. A lot of my students say they're working, asked to work 100 hours a week, and that is not sustainable. I'll say it to any of you who are working those kind of hours, that is not sustainable. And I think that, and you don't make good decisions. As leaders, you don't make good decisions by, you're not piece rate workers. You know, you have to have some way to reflect, some way to step back. So I think that I worry about that a lot, that all of our people, well, you know, you can have a big R&D shop, but you can burn people out and you'll never get any creativity. Innovation and creativity do not come from hours worked. In fact, they often come. Google gives all their people 20% of their time to come up with something that's not even a project they have, to create their own project. And some of their biggest inventions have come out of the 20% time. So I think we need to rethink the nature of work in this country and to take how do we get brain work better, and also how do we develop people's emotional intelligence so they can become better leaders. And and stop thinking that we can do everything by just working harder. I don't want to get to cliches like work smarter, but I do think it really becomes a function of really thinking about what we're asking people to do and how can they be most effective. Because yes, we're at risk of burning people out, and that's a great loss to our competitiveness as a country.
Several of our questioners are intrigued by your role as a director of Exxon and of Goldman, and they combined asking, what does a director do, and what is the role of a board member in organizations like Exxon and Goldman? A related question, when you come into an organization as a director, can you smell good and bad management? What do they smell like?
That's good. I have had the opportunity. I've served on 10 different corporate boards. I've had the privilege of serving on the board of some great companies. I think you can smell it, and you've got to get engaged. I think one of the big problems we've seen in the last 10, 15 years is terrible corporate governance. Board members who are asleep, they didn't step up to their responsibilities. When the crisis came, they disappeared. In many cases, they went out and fired the CEO and hired a new CEO and then didn't take any responsibility for what they were doing. I think I've seen in a number of companies significant improvements in governance, but I think it's a big, big problem. And so I'm proud to serve as a director of some great companies because I think it's an opportunity to try to build those companies. And as a director, you've got to ask the embarrassing question. Ask the question that no one wants anyone to ask. And I have a tendency to do that, and it kind of upsets people because sometimes I don't have as much information as I should have because you never have all the information. There's clear information asymmetry in which the management always has more information than the board. But I think it's the board's question to ask the left. I remember asking Hank Paulson, the board of Goldman, many, many times, Hank, what kind of systemic collapse could you have? Because they thought through all the logical risks. What kind of thing could come out of left field? I didn't know what they were. I said, you know, if you had a nuclear bomb go off in Kashmir, you know, but I mean, because I had no idea what they might be, and I wasn't smart enough to figure it out. But I think you have to ask those questions. And you also have to insist that the management and governance are balanced so that the management is not running the board and the board is clearly responsible. Now, I think the strong boards have stepped up. Look at the change in the General Motors board. I'm not saying it was a good thing or a bad thing that the CEO was terminated yesterday, but I can tell you that board was asleep for a long, long time. I can tell you the boards of those banks that went under, including Citigroup, were asleep. Now they've got new boards, but it's about time, you know, and I think it's led to significant problems. We've seen a real improvement in the Hewlett-Packard board out here, one of my role models as a company. And I just think we need to all, those of us who are qualified and asked to serve as directors, do that and devote the time. I think it takes a lot of time, and you should be prepared to devote the time. We had 15 board meetings with Goldman Sachs last fall. Citigroup had 53. Ann Mulcahy told me that she had 53 meetings. Well, you got to be prepared to be there. But I think the most important thing you do is have, not just select the right leader, but have the right management development process. We spent more time on that in the Goldman board, and when Hank Paulson caught me by surprise, calls me on Memorial Day, I'm off to see a Memorial Day ceremony at our local cemetery, and tells me he's going to take President Bush's offer as Secretary of the Treasury. It was a good thing we had Lloyd Blankfein who was there. Not only that, but that we knew the rest of management. We could promote two people to co-president. We knew who the top people were because we've been meeting with them. We've been talking about this hour after hour, even though we thought Paulson was going to be there another 3 to 5 years. And I think that's really important that we look at leadership succession top to bottom. We just went through one of those top to bottom issues with Exxon. We went way, way down in the organization, four levels down in the organization, and looked at hundreds of people and how they're doing, who's coming along, who are the young people coming up. And that's the kind of thing that's required to ensure that you have strong leadership succession. Because without that, no company can sustain its success.
Several of our folks in the audience are intrigued by the Harvard Business School and your experience there. Are they responsible for your success as a with being a student at the Harvard Business School?
Well, I came directly. I was one of those straight throughs. I was a young engineer from Michigan. They went to Georgia Tech, rather naive, rather narrow in my outlook, good at math and numbers, not very broad. And I think Harvard opened up my eyes to the world, particularly the world of global business, international business, and really complex values-based and ethical issues that I hadn't really studied. So I'd say no one organization ever is responsible for your success, but it was a great benefit to having been there. Now, I do have some concerns about business schools in general, that there's way too much focus on teaching people clever financial derivatives and techniques and not nearly enough focus on leadership and values. So the 6 years I've been at Harvard Business School, that's where I've been devoting my efforts because I think that's where we need to put our efforts and we need to make a big change. Some of my students last year created something called the MBA Oath, and it's somewhat controversial, but I think it's a very important thing. My son, who's a doctor, is in the back of the room, had to take an oath as a doctor. If you're a lawyer, you have to take an oath, and I think our young people ought to be asked to do that because I think way too often we're putting our self-interest ahead of the institution, ahead of the interests of the institution we're responsible for leading. And in the end of the day, that's what's really important. And I think we need to learn that. We need to realize it's not about us. It's not about me. It's about we. And if we don't learn that in business school, we're headed for potential problems later on. And it's not just about leaving business school and making a lot of money working for a hedge fund. It's much more complex than that. It's about really making a difference in serving society. Corporations are set up to do that, and I think business school is the place we got to learn that that's why you're there.
At the Harvard Business School, how do you teach emerging leaders to be, quote, authentic, unquote? Is being authentic something that a person can learn? How do they learn that from you?
Well, I tell them I'm not here. I'm not going to teach you how to be authentic or what your value should be, but we're going to try to create an environment which you can learn from each other. I do teach a course called Authentic Leadership Development. It's one of the most popular courses in the school now, and I have three other colleagues that are also teaching the course that we created. Came out of my book, True North. But I think, yes, I think we can learn what is true for us and what do we really believe and test those things. You say people's values are formed, but then you see people deviate from their values. So I think it is a period of knowing, putting together a program of how you're going to develop yourself as a leader. We've got this notion that leaders are made or born. This is a silly question. Everyone has to develop themselves as a leader just like you would as a musician or an athlete. You have to develop yourself, and it requires that, and that's what we hope to give them is a program for developing themselves as leaders. And it starts from within. I think great leaders are not people that know how to do things outside. They know how to do things inside. Every leader I've seen has failed, did not fail to lead other people. They failed to lead themselves. In that failing to lead themselves, they took a lot of people down with them. And leaders have enormous power. The reason I'm in business is because I think it can be a power for good, there can be a power for ill. And I think we need to call on our leaders to be that force for good to make a difference. I'm a fervent capitalist, but I really do believe that as capitalism, left to its own devices with no rules, will self-destruct. And I think it's our job to ensure that it does good in society because we're chartered by society and it can really make a difference. It's still the greatest economic system ever created, but we've got to get it right so we get the right kind of leaders leading our system that can restore a great capitalistic economy in the United States and around the world.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for only one last question, so let me ask you a simple one.
Like all the others you've asked me.
An audience member asks, please give us a picture of business and economy, of business slash economy 5 years from now, since you say we're entering a new era and your students should be achieving leadership by then.
Well, if it goes the way I'd like to see it, we'll have a lot of young leaders that are currently in their 20s and 30s and early 40s stepping up and taking over our organizations. We'll have a renewal of the great entrepreneurial spirit and unleashing of innovation in our major corporations that will break themselves up from these huge hierarchies and go to a lot of independent units that will be look more like the Internet in the way they organize than they will like a military organization of the past. And we will set on fire to know what we do so well. And we'll become great exporters of American ideas, and we'll be a very welcoming place for people of all races and nationalities that can bring the best that want to come here to have that opportunity to be great entrepreneurs. There's no country in America, in fact, there's no place like Northern California where entrepreneurship flourishes so well. And I think we need to play to that strength, not play to our old strengths of 100 years ago, but play to our great strengths. And if we do that, I think we will become a great nation and a great economy. And 5 years is a good goal to set ourselves to do that.
Let's say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Bill George, professor at the Harvard Business School and author of the new book, Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis. We thank our audiences here in San Francisco and on radio and television and on the Internet. I'm Bob Saldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place we are in the know, is adjourned.